You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing what's big this week in global affairs. We'll also be asking where Ghana's oil industry sits in Africa's energy sector.
Ghana is sort of the darling of Africa right now because it has, you know, it's set up things quite nicely. It's been investing in health and education for years and in its civil service, but it does have still an infrastructure challenge.
We'll discuss the highs and lows of the Viennese ball season. We'll be asking whether the open plan office is really the best working environment, and we'll hear from the curator of a new Van Gogh exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum. All that plus some great music. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. All that ahead in the next 60 minutes. Before all that, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. In the latest diplomatic moves to end hostilities in Syria, an Arab League resolution calling for a political transition in Syria has gained support from at least 10 members of the UN Security Council. Meanwhile, Moscow, a permanent UN Security Council member with veto powers, has offered to host talks in an effort to end the bloodshed. The Arab League has had to suspend its monitoring mission because of the escalation in violence. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the observers can only do so much anyway.
Monitoring mission may be helpful in assessing the situation, but even before monitoring mission goes there, the Syrian leadership should take a firm action, decisive action at this time, to stop the violence.
European leaders struggle to reconcile austerity with growth today at a summit due to approve a permanent rescue fund for the Eurozone and put finishing touches to a German-driven pact for stricter budget discipline. Officially, the half-day summit was meant to focus mainly on ways to rekindle growth and create jobs. But disputes over the limits of austerity and about Greece's unresolved debt restructuring negotiations with private bondholders may sour efforts to send a more optimistic message that Europe is getting on top of its debt crisis. A Norwegian court has convicted two men of plotting to blow up a Danish newspaper that had printed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in an Al-Qaeda-linked case which underscored the threats of extremist violence in Scandinavia. Ringleader Mikael Davoud, a Norwegian of Chinese Muslim origin, was sentenced to 7 years in prison for the plot, while an Iraqi Kurd with Norwegian residency got 3.5 years. Rescue teams were lowered onto the side of the capsized cruise ship Costa Concordia today as a new passageway was opened up, allowing teams to reach areas previously not searched. Professor Riccardo Fanti from the University of Florence says the ship has shifted more than 4 centimetres in 6 hours, suggesting one of two possible scenarios.
One is that the ship is going through elastic and plastic deformations. That is, it is settling under its own weight. The other scenario is that the ship is moving like a rigid body all in one block, therefore slipping into the seabed.
Millions of Indians went to the polls today in two northern states where the country's ruling Congress party hopes to regain momentum after a year when its reputation was battered by corruption scandals and a slowing economy. Congress is aiming to wrest back control of Punjab and Uttarakhand states, which are ruled by the main opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and its allies, as part of a series of elections in 5 states that end in early March. The World Food Programme says conflict and food shortages could push up to 500,000 Sudanese refugees to flee to South Sudan in the next couple of months if Khartoum does not allow aid agencies more access to its restive border regions. South Sudan seceded in July under a 2005 peace deal that ended a decades-long civil war with the North, but fighting has continued on both sides of the poorly drawn border. The world's major pharmaceutical companies joined forces with governments and leading global health organizations today to donate drugs and scientific know-how to help control or wipe out 10 neglected tropical diseases by 2020. More than 1.2 billion people around the world suffer from tropical diseases. Professor Simon Croft from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine explains the impact they have.
Many of these diseases make people feel ill, They affect nutritional status. That means they look malnourished because the worms are eating all their food, essentially. And it also, for young children and those of school age, it actually affects their educational attainment.
And brief airline news. Hungarian airline Marlev said it doesn't have the financing to keep going hours after the government took preparatory steps to restructure the loss-making carrier and protect it from bankruptcy proceedings. The French airline carrier Aigle Azur is to start bi-weekly passenger flights between Paris and Tripoli in Libya. And Ryanair, Europe's biggest budget airline, has raised its full-year profit forecast as a 17% rise in fares made up for more expensive fuel and reduced capacity. Ryanair soared past analyst forecasts with a net profit of €50 million in its third quarter to December the 31st. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. Time now for a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And in Europe, it's likely to be the coldest period of the entire winter. By midweek, most of the major cities in Europe will be sub-zero by day. Even in Western Europe, severe frosts at night to anywhere from -5 in London to -30 in some parts of Eastern Europe. The cold spell is likely to stay for at least a week. Southern Europe, cold too, with a mix of rain, hail and even some snow. Tuesday's city outlook: in London, only 3 degrees and cloudy, in Frankfurt, 0 with light snow flurries, Oslo, -4 with snow flurries, and in Vienna, -2 and partly cloudy. Across the Atlantic to North America now, and a lot of sunny weather to talk about, and mild too for Long Island, so for New Yorkers, it'll be bright most of the week, perhaps a little rain midweek. California is looking sunny too. However, Alaska, which has been pounded by a number of severe winter storms this season, is suffering from extreme cold, -46 Celsius recently in Fairbanks. Okay, Tuesday's city forecast then. In New York, 12 degrees and sunny. In Chicago, it's a mild 7 with a few showers. Los Angeles, 20, warm sunshine here. And in Toronto, a mild 7 degrees and partly cloudy. Here's a look at some other world destinations. In Japan, standard winter weather, so chilly winds with snow showers in the north for Hokkaido. To the south in Tokyo, milder, highs of 5 to 10 degrees the next few days with some sunshine. And in China, in Shanghai, around 10 Celsius on Tuesday, only 3 degrees by Thursday. That's it. So I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's just coming up to 8 minutes past the hour.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo so.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, every Monday here on Midori House, we like to check in with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to find out which stories are catching his interest. And he joins me in the studio now.
Hello.
A very warm welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
What stories are catching your eye this week?
Well, I'm glad you described it as that, because in the office, everyone has said this section is called Steve's Global Affairs.
Yes.
Which I must say has slightly sort of concerned me.
I wasn't entirely sure whether it was appropriate to ask you.
No.
Can we stick to foreign affairs on a... No, I don't think there's any way of saying this. What's happening in the world news, Steve?
So three interesting stories, I think, for this week. And they've been going on at the moment that perhaps one of them hasn't been getting much coverage. The other two maybe have, but here we are. So let's start with the one which hasn't been getting much coverage. This is the African Union Summit, which is coming to an end right now in Addis Ababa. And it's usually sort of relatively interesting and doesn't get a great deal of coverage. But what's interesting about it, particularly this time, is the first summit since the fall of Gaddafi.
Mm.
And now Gaddafi essentially bankrolled the African Union.
Oh, did he? Okay.
He not only... He wanted to set up a United States of Africa and wanted to be known as the King of Kings in Africa, a title which he did actually give himself. But he, lots of other African leaders thought, no, not so sure about that, but sort of let him carry on and do his thing because he was funding so much.
Well, there were so many nations which were potentially able to offer him shelter,
exactly.
Were he able to get out of the country, as a lot of his family managed to get out to. So he wasn't universally hated.
No,
politically,
not by the leaders.
Politically, he was universally hated, yeah. But like you say, it was the leaders who would offer him a sort of an open arm.
No, indeed. And so because he wanted to be the king of African kings, he 15% of the African Union's budget was officially paid for by Libya. But aside from that, he also paid the dues for a number of other West African countries as well. So Burkina Faso, Mali, these countries didn't pay their normal dues for the African Union themselves. Libya did. Of course, that's not going to happen anymore.
So where does it leave them?
China. China's spending an awful lot of money.
Which is why they're the guest of honour this year.
Exactly. Also because China had started to do a little bit this already. They funded the new $200 million convention centre, the African Union Convention Centre in Addis Ababa, which is sort of the capital of the AU. In fact, we did a story about, we sent Sophie Grove about three years ago to Addis, did a big story about the AU in Addis. And that centre finally opened over the weekend, and China was there. Lots of other leaders from around the world were there as well, or officials from around the world, to try and, you know, get the AU's ear. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next with that. The one actual story that comes out of this summit from the actual politics is that they couldn't decide who the chairman was going to be of the African Union, which shouldn't normally matter. It's kind of a, you know, he's not really the public face of it. Most people have probably never heard of Jean Ping, who is the current AU chairman.
He has got a great name.
He has
so
got
will
a
not
great
be
name,
forgotten.
Jean Ping. What was interesting, though, was there was a split in the vote between Francophone Africa and Anglophone Africa, with Francophone wanting Mr. Ping, Monsieur Ping, and Anglophone not. So that's one potential thing to keep an eye on.
Monsieur Ping was
weeks.
Mentioned at the beginning of the summit that 2011 had been a particularly hard year, because it was the first time in a very, very long time that Western institutions were coming in very, very hard and fast and imposing solutions on Africa, which in previous years they probably hadn't done, but their degree of intervention was, in his words, testing the strength of Africa's unity.
This is because there were certain leaders within Africa that were allied to Gaddafi. Monsieur Ping is one of them. Jacob Zuma, President of South Africa, was another, who in fact actually castigated the UN and NATO about 2 weeks ago when he was at the UN in New York and saying, you know, that NATO completely ignored the African Union's suggestions for peace talks and negotiations and went ahead with their own plans. Not many people in South Africa, ordinary voters, would agree with President Zuma's views on this. There's a very clear disconnect between what a lot of African leaders are saying and what African voters actually believe, you know, was the right thing to do with Gaddafi.
There's also the idea of justice as well, which is linked into all this. And the International Criminal Court was where Gaddafi's son was going to be tried. And you saw it, you know, a couple of years ago with Charles Taylor and the Blood Diamond trial, that it felt like Western rules of law were being imposed on Africa.
It doesn't look good. The optics are not good with this, with the International Criminal Court, in that all the cases so far have been in Africa. But there are very good reasons for this, because the ICC's chief prosecutor can only open a case when one of, I think, three things happen. One is when a country says, we can't deal with this issue.
You have it.
Exactly. And so that's what happened in Congo. That's what happened in Uganda. That's sort of what's happening in Kenya. So there's that. Another case is when the UN Security Council says, we want this to be dealt with, and it's passed over. So that's what happened with Sudan, with Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, with what happened in Darfur. And when the vote was taken at the UN, Benin and I can't remember the other African country that was on the Security Council at the time, both voted in favour of it. So it doesn't look good that they're all African, but there's very good reasons why they actually have been.
Now let's move on to your second topic of interest.
Yes. This is Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy campaigning together. We're going to go into this a bit more depth on tonight's Daily, which is 2200 London hours. London hours? London time.
London time. 2200 hours
London
time.
There we are. Got there eventually. but this is a fascinating story. Angela Merkel is going to campaign alongside Nicolas Sarkozy.
Which makes you wonder, what has Merkel got to gain from this? Because Sarkozy has everything to gain.
Merkel has an awful lot to gain as well, because she is very worried about Francois Hollande, who's the socialist opposition leader
and
presidential
a
candidate.
Much more favoured candidate at the moment because
exactly.
French hates Sarkozy.
He's the favourite to win, although French socialists have been favourite to win and messed it up in the past.
It's never been a guarantee.
Yep. But, you know, the policies that Hollande is suggesting are, in the circumstances, quite radical. They're sort of traditional left-wing policies.
Yeah, so taxing the rich.
We're going to raise taxes on the rich and, you know, it's Robin Hood. And, you know, we're going to spend it on education and we're going to spend it on jobs for people who are unemployed. And they're also talking about euro bonds, they're also talking about financial taxes, lots of things that Angela Merkel doesn't like. What's fascinating about this is that, you know, in lots of other countries, and we'll wait to see what happens in France, the idea that another country's leader will come to your country and say, I think you should vote for this chap, wouldn't go down very well.
Apart from in France, where the French are seen as liking Merkel more than they like Sarkozy.
Well, this is the odd thing. Yes, they do. There was a poll in Le Monde recently saying that Merkel is more popular than Sarkozy amongst the French. I think that she's going to be less popular when people start thinking, sorry, what's it got to do with you? This is our election. That's going to be interesting. So that's something to look at.
You've
as well.
Heard it. You've heard of it before when there's been a large union. There's been pan-European issues when, you know, Helmut Kohl and Mitterrand got together and pushed together for closer European union. But I've never heard of it happening with one country's leader supporting another one. It seems to be sort of someone just jumping straight in, particularly because apparently Sarkozy doesn't even like Merkel very much. Wasn't there a joke about cheese?
There was,
before Christmas?
Yeah, they haven't always been the best of friends. I mean, they've become a bit closer in recent months. You know, crisis always brings people together.
Doesn't it just?
So they've become a bit closer. And obviously, you know, for Angela Merkel, she's worried for two reasons on this. One is if Hollande wins, then that changes everything in Europe. Also, it makes it very difficult for her in 2013 when she's running for re-election. If the left have won in France and, you know, it's 1 year on and their policies haven't completely bankrupted France, and actually France is looking all right, then she can't turn around and say that the SPD, the Social Democrats in Germany...
Who Hollande gets on with.
Yeah, yeah. That she can't say, oh, no, they're going to ruin Germany, because people say, well, they haven't ruined France.
Do you think this might be playing into the hands of Merkel's master plan of ever closer fiscal and political union?
I think it's, you know, everything's changing remarkably quickly in Europe, you know, in terms of, you know, the politics of it and cooperation. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I would be surprised if she really goes on the campaign trail with him. And I would be surprised if she does, very surprised if it actually works, because it just doesn't feel right.
No, but that's never stopped us before. What's the third thing that you want to talk to us about?
The third thing is an old favourite. It's the US Republican race.
Hooray.
But it's an old favourite that may well go. I've said this before.
You have.
And I was wrong before.
I love watching this. I've never been that interested, right, but now I'm just glued to how bonkers they are.
Yes, indeed. Well, look, I mean, Romney is going to win the Florida primary,
yes,
which is on Tuesday. That's tomorrow.
Conclusion.
Almost certainly to happen. But then the interesting thing will be what happens next. Do they try... Romney's team will try and change the terms of debate and make this look as if it's all over now. He's front runner. He's going to win. Let's start talking about who his VP is going to be. Let's take the fight to Obama. Gingrich, you'll see, isn't going to let him. But
that's going to who is going to be his VP?
Well, Mario Rubio, mm-hmm, who's the young Florida senator, Latino, he's a possible name. Chris Christie, who's the governor in New Jersey, who decided not to run for president, but yeah, he's another possible, although that makes it a little bit northeast if it's Romney as a candidate. And who knows, maybe there's going to be a couple of others that come out of the woodwork. One other person who it might be, we might have another Bush. Jeb Bush, governor of Florida, has so
far... He of the hanging chad?
Yes, indeed. He was always seen as the brighter Bush,
right,
you know, of the two.
Well, that's reassuring.
And he has kept himself out of this race, both in terms of not being a candidate, but also hasn't backed either Romney or Gingrich. There's a possibility that he might be considered as VP, because that might make it easier for him, post-Romney, to go for the White House.
Steve, thank you very much indeed for joining
us. Is that right?
That's lovely.
Good.
That
okay.
You've filled us in on the world now.
There we are.
Don't need to bother. We can go back to our little bunkers now. Steve Bloomfield, foreign editor for Monocle. Thank you very much. The time is 20 minutes past the hour, and in a moment we'll be assessing how a year after oil came on stream, Ghana's using its natural resource to its maximum potential.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21 minutes past the hour. A little over a year ago, Ghana joined the ranks of the African countries which produce oil. In the latest edition of Monocle magazine, our senior editor Sophie Grove visited Ghana to learn of the blossoming oil industry, which is modelled on Norwegian systems. Well, earlier today I spoke with Dr. Valerie Marcel. She's Associate Fellow of the Energy, Environment and Development Programme at London's Chatham House think tank. I started by asking Dr. Marcel why Norway had been chosen as the ideal model.
I think a lot of oil producers out there are concerned, looking at examples like Nigeria or Angola or even Iran, you know, thinking, oh, those people have really mismanaged their precious resource, and the Norwegians have done so well. And so they look to Norway to see what they did so that they can replicate it. And essentially, the Norwegian model, on the one hand, is managing your revenues to sort of save them for the future, the revenues that come from oil. And on the other hand, it's how you organize your sector so that it's a bit like checks and balances. The ministry takes care of policymaking, the national oil company takes care of, you know, the oil business and operations, and an independent regulator sort of does the licensing and manages all the foreign oil companies. And I think, you know, the question that I have looking at Africa and a lot of really underdeveloped countries is how well can they be expected to follow the Norwegian example when it's a country that is extremely developed with very high education and health, very established civil service, of course. And so for a country that has just a few engineering graduates every year, you know, there's a question of how well they can replicate that.
When you talk about the infrastructure, do you think it's also dependent on the fact that Ghana has a stable democracy?
Yes, I think Ghana is a very sort of the darling of Africa right now because it has, you know, it's set up things quite nicely. It's been investing in health and education for years and in its civil service. So it has a very, you know, relatively qualified civil service that gives it good chances of being able to manage policy and the oil sector relatively well, but it does have still an infrastructure challenge. And in Ghana, it's a question also of which region is benefiting from infrastructure development or job growth, and I think the north is not benefiting quite well. So there are big challenges still there.
When you talk about managing the oil sector, how does a government balance that management with the fact that it needs a lot of inward investment, such as the likes of Shell and Elf, to come in and from the private sector exploit these great resources?
Well, the management of the sector is really about, you know, devising good terms for investment so that you leverage your oil and gas development to create jobs or to create opportunities for your economy, which is a very difficult thing to do because the oil sector is capital intensive and it doesn't normally create jobs. It's also about, you know, creating good regulations on health, safety and environment. And it's about than having very clear division of roles and responsibilities. Because once big money starts coming, everybody wants a piece of it. And there's a huge tendency to, very tempting situation is to, you know, for say every part of the state wants to have some control over the money, and then there can be confusion, and then really you start to mismanage your sector.
How do you also ensure that it is Ghanaians who are in charge of the sector? Because there's a great brain drain in the 1970s when bright Ghanaians left to make their fortunes elsewhere. How do you stop that from happening, or indeed encourage Ghanaians back to Ghana?
Well, I think they are coming back because it is a very, it's a growing economy and it has good, good prospects for the future. And with oil production now coming on stream, it's an attractive place to come back to, I think, compared to the previous decades. So Ghanaians are in charge. They are handling their own oil sector. I think they have foreign oil companies doing operations because they do not yet have the skills and experience to be able to handle their own operations. But there are very few producers in Africa that have achieved that level of, say, sector experience to be able to actually do operations without foreign oil companies.
It was only last year that Ghana joined the ranks of those African countries that produce oil. Where do you think there are still gaps that need to be filled? What do they still need to learn?
Well, I think that, when major revenues come on stream, I think they're going to have to continue to increase their civil service management and auditing capacities so that they can really regulate the performance of the oil companies and manage the revenues carefully. But the big gap, I think, is on the national oil company and for it to learn how to manage oil sector projects. That's a very, it's a new challenge for the national oil company, even though it's existed since 1983. It hasn't been in charge of any fields, and so I think it's going to try and learn those skills so that eventually it can take over the reins of some of these fields.
And you mentioned earlier on that it should not get into the trap of Nigeria. We also see situations between Sudan and South Sudan at the moment. What can it learn from its neighbours?
Yes, I think what's happening in Sudan and South Sudan is extremely worrying right now because there's a possibility of going back into serious conflict between them, and I think it's in the case of Ghana, I think it's in a different situation because it doesn't have that tense relationship with neighbors, and it's not landlocked as South Sudan is, and so needing to has no export terminals and no capacity to sell its oil, South Sudan, unless it goes through Sudan. Ghana doesn't have those kinds of restrictions, so. I think in a way it's rather blessed in the timing and geographic location of the country for oil development.
And that was the oil expert, Dr. Valerie Marcel from London's Chatham House. You're listening to Midori House. And taking us to the news at the bottom of the hour, we have some music. This is Toro y Moi and Divina. And that was Divina by Toro y Moi. Coming up in the next half hour in Midori House, we'll be asking why the Austrians have retained their ball season. But first, here's the news with Nick.
Thanks, Emma. In the latest diplomatic moves to end hostilities in Syria, an Arab League resolution calling for a political transition in Syria has gained support from at least 10 members of the UN Security Council. Street battles raged at the gates of the Syrian capital today as President Assad's troops sought to consolidate their grip on suburbs that rebel fighters had taken only a few miles from the centre of government power. European leaders struggled to reconcile austerity with growth today at a summit due to approve a permanent rescue fund for the Eurozone and put finishing touches to a German-driven pact for stricter budget discipline. A Norwegian court has convicted two men of plotting to blow up a Danish newspaper that had printed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Rescue teams were lowered onto the side of the capsized cruise ship Costa Concordia today as a new passageway was opened up, allowing teams to reach areas previously not searched. Millions of Indians went to the polls today in two northern states where the country's ruling Congress party hopes to gain momentum after a year when its reputation was battered by corruption scandals and a slowing economy. The world's major pharmaceutical companies joined forces with governments and leading global health organisations today to donate drugs and scientific know-how to help control or wipe out 10 neglected tropical diseases by 2020. Coast Guards and naval forces of the Gulf Cooperation Council group of Arab countries have contingency plans for a possible attempt by Iran to shut the Strait of Hormuz. And the Hungarian airline Malev says it doesn't have the financing to keep going. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. We'll see you in a little under half an hour for the latest update. First of all, though, we're going to be talking about being at the height of the Austrian, or rather the Viennese, ball season. From late December to mid-February, a ball is held in honour of countless professions and sections of society, from the Jäger or Huntsman's Ball to the Wiener Kaffeesieder or Coffee Shop Owner's Ball. And what about the WKR, the Wiener Korporationsring Ball that was held last week, which included guests from various far-right parties from across Europe? But although all these balls are widely advertised to tourists, is there something that smacks of imperialism to the whole, about the whole affair? Well, to discuss this, joining us now on the line is the award-winning journalist Sarah Wildman, who's written extensively on Vienna and the ball scene there for the New York Times. Well, I'm also pleased to say that we're also joined from Vienna by the journalist Christoph Zotter from Datum magazine. He went to the WKR ball undercover last week. A very warm welcome to you both. Sarah, may I begin with you first? Tell us about the background to this. This is inherent in Austrian culture in a way that it doesn't seem to be present in anyone else's.
Well, I think that's right. It smacks of the sort of end of the imperial era. It's sort of one of the last things beyond the architecture of the city that allows people to understand both the history and the pomp and circumstance of a period that most of us don't remember and don't even have grandparents who would remember. It's a time of, you know, great, incredible dress and incredible wealth, and it's something that Vienna celebrates every year for days and days on end.
It's something that smacks of city and privilege, isn't it? In the same way the Austrian villagers still go to church in their tracht, in their dress every Sunday. The Viennese love to dress up in a particular way and enact particular rituals, don't they?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, look, this is Vienna was a city that was at the center of the world until the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, until the end of the Habsburg Empire. And this is something that is a little bit of a reminder of it, in some ways even more so, I think, than attending church. It's something that everybody can embrace in a way that's a bit more secular. And at the same time, it references a time of great importance that the city has lost. And so I think that's part of the reason why it's so celebrated. It is elite, though. I mean, it has broadened in the last few years. Now, of course, as you mentioned at the beginning, there's a doctor's ball and a pharmacist's ball and a coffee owner's ball. But at the same time, and now there's also a gay and lesbian ball, which has just been for the past few years. But at the same time, the amount of money it costs to put them up, you know, something like $1 million just to stage them, plus the dress, plus the cost of the ticket, plus everything, it's obviously not meant for all of society to attend.
Has this been something that's faded out of fashion at all? Has there been, or are we enjoying a resurgence at the moment?
I think in the last 20 years, you saw a little bit of a sense of it being old-fashioned and not something that kids were doing. And then recently, it started becoming a little bit more, I wouldn't say hip, but it's something that people have started to gravitate back towards and that has been embraced again by a younger generation. And you'll see that the dancing schools that have been around, the Tanzschule Ehrmeier, which is in the first district, is still packed with students and has a huge debutante season, something that, you know, certainly in the United States we'd never see anything like on such a broad group of society. Most children do learn to waltz, which is something that is not, most of us can't say.
Christoph Zotter, let's ask you now, what kind of people are we seeing at balls in Vienna nowadays?
Well, that depends on what kind of balls you go to. I have to add to Sarah's comment that also balls are highly networking institutions in Vienna. So there is people from elite institutions or certain kind of parts of society that try to network on these balls, and that's also what we saw at the WKR ball on Friday.
Now, you mentioned the Vicky Air Ball, which was attended by the likes of Marine Le Pen from France. You went undercover. What was it like?
Well, it strikes you as a rather obscure event on the one hand. On the other hand, I have to say, it is a normal ball like every other ball. Like, people dress up, people do dance. It's a normal event. What's different about it is the symbolism. You see a lot of German flags. You see people dressing up in the typical corporate designs of the student unions. It's a student unions ball of German nationalistic unions. So that's what makes it so different to any other ball.
It was also, is this the Burschenschaft Ball, which has something to do with German unity as well? So it does smack with a sort of a very far right character.
Well, it is. The thing about this ball is that it is organized by the Burschenschaft, which claims a German nationalistic character, which traces back far in time. And it's also used by the FPÖ, the Freiheitliche Partei Österreich, the far-right-wing party in Austria, to network with European far-right-wing parties, such as Front National by Marine Le Pen, but also Swedish far-right-wing parties, Belgian far-right-wing parties, Danish. They're all there. They're all invited and enjoy, a nice evening in Vienna where they can talk about the politics and kind of get to know each other.
So can we try and address how this thing works, Andy? So you have the idea of a ball, which is a legitimate and enjoyable evening. Is something like the Burschenschaft Ball an excuse to legitimise the far right? Or is it symptomatic of the fact that the Austrians are a lot more comfortable with the far right? I mean, we remember the likes of Jörg Haider, who was so popular in Austria a few years ago.
Well, I think you have to distinguish that one. The Burschenschaft are the far right-wing extremists. And the right-wing in Austria is a different topic. I wouldn't put that in the same pot. But, of course, it's a highly symbolic thing, and it is very, it strikes you as very different from any other country, especially with the history that Austria has combined with the German, nation. And also, as I can tell you from the bar, there is German flags everywhere. The Burschenschaft themselves pride themselves with German flags. They're claiming that they have a common culture, that the Austrian culture and the German culture are the same. So that is what makes it a lot different.
Sarah, what would you make of this? Something which ostensibly is a celebration of Austrian identity and imperialism, but actually does have quite a nasty underside to it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, what's interesting to me is that this is cloaked in a sort of tourist, pretty, wrapped up in a bow sort of event. But at the same time, the fact that you have the meeting of all the far right of Europe and that Marine Le Pen was there, that Vlaams Belang was there, it actually shows a common cause of a sort of strain of xenophobia that exists across the far right of Europe. To me, it seems a peculiar, almost, it seems to me that it's a masking of the kind of nastiness of this event within this sort of very, very bright and glittery packaging of the Viennese ball season. In a way, it's a way of them meeting without it seeming to be so pernicious as it is. And that to me is really striking. I've actually sat down with the far right in Europe, in both France and in Belgium, and they both talk about how they've distanced themselves from the far right in Austria because the far right in Austria still has a sort of anti-Semitic overtone that connects back to the period of the Nazi period of the 30s and the Second World War, whereas the Front National in France and the Vlaams Belang in Belgium have tried very hard to make overtures towards Jewish voters, to talk about how their parties are different from the far right parties of the past. And the fact that they've all gathered together in a celebration like this says that they actually have much more common cause than they'd like to admit.
This hasn't gone unnoticed, though, in Austria, because the head of the Green Party accused the people who went to the Burschenschaft Ball last week of dancing on the graves of Auschwitz. It coincided, the ball coincided with Holocaust Memorial Day. Is there still a strong appetite for this kind of thing in Austria, or is there a general intolerance of it?
I mean, I would say that, first of all, I mean, and we can discuss whether that this is right, but obviously the Austrians, it took them a very long time to let go of the label that they were the quote-unquote first victims of Hitler. I mean, up until very recently, and in fact on the anniversary of Anschluss just a few years ago, Otto Habsburg still used this canard that the Viennese and that Austria in general were first victims, that they weren't celebrating the annexation. And, you know, I think that it took a very long time for Austria to come to it. Come to terms with its past in the same way that Germany did. It has started to now, but if you look at a few projects, for example, just this past year, there's been a project at the University of Vienna to commemorate and honor all of the students who were expelled in March of 1938 after Anschluss, because, of course, all Jewish students and almost every single professor were expelled immediately from the school when Hitler marched into Vienna. The fact that the commemoration of those students took place in this decade, you know, 70-something years later, shows you that it's been very, very difficult for the country to come to terms with its past, to recognize that victimization and participation are not actually really the same and one and the same.
Sarah Wellman and Christoph Zotter, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's 18 minutes before the head top of the hour. In a moment, we'll be hearing about whether we should be redesigning our office spaces. Stay with us.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in. And it's covered everything from Moose moving into Anchorage to Jan Gehl's plans to Copenhagenize the world, one bike lane at a time.
Density is something about plonking down towers, and if you have enough towers, you have a city.
Join us as we meet the people planning a better urban future and the odd lumbering shaggy beast too. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Is there a brave or rather old new office world just around the corner? Will we be sitting in 1950s sealed-off booths, unable to talk to each other? Well, a new book by Susan Cain has just been published, suggesting that an introverted, solitary style of working may be more conducive to creativity than the open-plan offices which have become so increasingly fashionable in the last decade. How much of this U-turn are we seeing already in our offices? Recently, our senior editor, Sophie Grove, sat down with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, to discuss the evolving office environment.
So Hugo, Susan Cain, the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts.
In a world that can't stop talking.
Yeah.
I love the pause that you put there before Quiet.
Hello, Quiet.
This is a wonderful new book, which is just about to hit the shelves, written by Susan Cain, who's an American lady and has done a lot of research to dispel the myth that in order to have a successful functioning creative office, you need to be open plan and have everybody talking and sharing their ideas 24/7, which is something that I feel quite strongly about as well, actually.
So she's looking back really at some of history's genii and saying, well, look, they weren't in brainstorming sessions, they weren't in open plan hot desking situations, they were alone, and actually that's when you have your inspiration.
Exactly, that you need room and space and time by yourself. And that also, I think she sort of goes into the character sort of these individuals who have created extraordinary things in the past, and they were solitary people who maybe if they were in an environment, a creative office environment that seems to be on vogue today, that they wouldn't have had the time or the space to have done the achievements that they did.
And the idea is you have to sort of incubate talent and not have this kind of cacophony going on around you where you have to collaborate. And she's quoting Picasso saying, without great solitude, no serious work is possible. How does that reflect in a design sense? I mean, are you seeing a trend towards sort of kind of solitary confinement in the workplace, or is it more, is it this kind of collectivization?
Well, I think everybody's very aware of the much documented sort of Google office style, where it's all open plan and table tennis tournaments at lunchtime and space opera races in the evening, and that somehow this translates into business success for companies. And many, many businesses, not just in the creative industries, have thought that, you know, we need to tear down our walls and have everybody seeing each other and talking to each other to create the most, sort of the best operating environment for people. But actually, funnily enough, at Orgatech, which is the biannual office furniture trade fair, it happens every 2 years in Cologne, and the next one will be this autumn,
even 2 years ago, there was a slight move away from open plan offices. All the big sort of global furniture manufacturers who specialise in office furniture were beginning to reintroduce sort of solitary pods. So there were booths to make phone calls in. There were sort of little nest chairs that fully cocoon people who can go and sit and spend an hour working by themselves where they would know that people wouldn't disturb them. And it sort of feels like it's come 360. It's not quite as severe as those sort of solid partitions that people think of as huge kind of call centre offices in the 50s and 60s, which are still very much around today. And it's sort of seen as the enemy to having a harmonious office environment. It's somewhere in between where, you know, largely open plan, but people are beginning to recognise the importance of having a space where you can go and be by yourself.
And do you think, I mean, she says that 70% of office workers in the US have open plan. Do you think that the booths have got a bad name and, you know, they're so synonymous with these kind of horrible, you know, polyester kind of, cubicles that you see in sort of 80s films, that actually they've just been sort of thrown out and now we've got this, there's too much, it's open space and no privacy?
Yes, I do, definitely. I think it is a question of sort of gradual reintroduction and not just putting these awful sort of whiteboards back up in between desks to keep everybody isolated. It's more about having options and choice. And the best designed offices that we see today are the ones that sort of use a mixture of open plan and sort of solitary confinement. Sounds a bit harsh, but giving people the option to go and spend some time by themselves and not feel like they're strange or that they're sort of creating a bad atmosphere by wanting to just go and have a bit of a think and a bit of time and space. I mean, it's something that we in our own offices are very fortunate to have the luxury to do that.
Exactly. We do have open plan, but then there's lots of nooks and crannies.
I know, I think nooks and crannies are the way forward.
Yeah, and do you think that there's a more of a kind of sophistication about, you know, eye contact or maybe even acoustics and the way these things have been designed, that's actually, you know, you can have both?
Definitely. And the sort of pods that I'm speaking of, and which I'm sure are going to come with a vengeance at Orgatech in, I think it's October, they're made of soft furnishings and they have little sort of pull-down desks that you can go and sit in and sort of bring your laptop with you. They're not sort of harsh, sterile environments that you would sit and feel a little bit sort of lonely and isolated. They're very much designed to fit into a sort of nicely designed office with, like you say, good acoustics and soft materials, and there's a lot of sort of natural wood and things as well. So they're not hostile in any way.
And do you think this is, like Susan Cain says, sort of a revaluation of the introvert? Not everybody has to be this team player, this brainstorming person. Actually, you know, the silent but mysterious power of the individual is coming back.
Definitely. What I like the most is the point that she makes that if you're forced to always share your ideas, or you're not allowed to actually have an opinion unless you have reached that opinion through a meeting with 15 colleagues, you know, people get a bit lazy and everybody sort of begins to sit back and think or just agree with each other. And the first person to speak is usually the person whose opinion goes to the top. It's the person who shouts the loudest. And often it's the person who is a little bit quiet and doesn't necessarily want to turn every idea that they have into a full-on hour-long brainstorming session with the entire office.
So you're a lone maverick, in other words. That's what you're saying.
I am a bit of a lone maverick.
Lone maverick or collective pie chart, happy in a group with a whiteboard.
Exactly.
No. Take your pick.
A little blackboard, maybe, in a little pod in the corner of the office by myself, just creating genius.
And that was Monocle's lone maverick, Hugo MacDonald, talking to senior editor Sophie Grove earlier today about the importance of nooks and crannies in the workplace. It's 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Now in Midori House, we head to Philadelphia, where there is a new, important Vincent van Gogh exhibition opening. The final years of van Gogh's life were undoubtedly his most prolific, marking a period of intense work. This new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art explores the radical nature of this later period in his career. Monocle's Barrett Austin caught up with Jenny Thompson, who's the museum's curator, to learn a bit more about how van Gogh managed to secure his place in the history of art.
Van Gogh Up Close offers a very unique and new perspective on the artist's paintings of landscapes and of still lives. Van Gogh is, of course, a very well-known artist, one that's been very well studied, but we've never it's never been noted before that he's taken this very intense, very what we're calling close-up view of nature in the work he was producing between 1886 and 1890.
How much scholarship has been devoted to Van Gogh's close-ups? Is this show the sort of first of its kind? It seems that it is, but sort of from an academic or art historical perspective, how much focus has been placed on the close-ups?
Yeah, the close-ups are actually sort of brand new. In fact, we coined the phrase close-up just for this exhibition. And scholars have been noting for a number of years that there are some very unusual things going on in some of Van Gogh's paintings, particularly these works that have to do with nature, and have noted that there are distortions of space and scale and perspective, but no one had ever taken a close look at them before. And this was a great opportunity to bring them all together and look at them side by side.
So altogether, what did this show set out to accomplish that other shows had not done in the past?
They're works that are not often seen together. So we've brought together things that have not often been exhibited or lesser known works by Van Gogh, but have this very strong play of space and sort of zooming in on the foreground element to the paintings. But also because this is a very innovative, it's a very new, fresh look at the artist. And they, I will say, are very strong and appealing pictures just in themselves.
So the show begins with works from 1886, the year that Van Gogh arrived in Paris. How is the influence of the artist that he was exposed to in Paris shown in the works on display here?
It's really the confrontation with Impressionism that really shook him. He'd actually never seen an Impressionist picture before he arrived in Paris in 1886. And the Impressionists had been exhibiting and painting for about a dozen years. So it's quite extraordinary that their work simply wasn't known in the Netherlands. And Van Gogh sort of goes through this very intense period of studying the Impressionists, studying the Post-Impressionists, going to exhibitions, meeting Signac, Seurat, Monet, all of these artists. And it's a period of great absorption of a lot of ideas, but then he really takes that on and feels a strong drive to produce pictures of great originality. And this is where the close-up comes in, that this is one of his responses and one of his ways of trying to establish a name for himself and to place himself within this group of very accomplished artists.
And could you tell us a little bit about some of the visual techniques that Van Gogh explores in these works?
Sure, there are a number of different devices he uses in the close-ups, and that's one of, I think, the exciting things that we see in the exhibition is that he's not doing just one thing in these works, that he's applying a number of different, what we might call pictorial strategies. So he'll use extreme cropping, so that instead of seeing an entire forest, you just might see a single tree trunk sort of crossing the canvas. He'll use lots of distortions of space, so things will seem to tip and toss and slip and slide all over the canvas in front of you. Some canvases have very high horizon lines, so the sky is just a tiny sliver at the top of the canvas, and it looks as if the ground is actually sort of rising up to meet you. And this offered him a great opportunity to show very detailed flowers or wheat sheaves in the foreground.
And in addition to the 40 or so works that we see on display here, there are also a number of comparative works that are also shown alongside Van Gogh's work. Could you tell us a little bit about some of these works in particular and how their styles or subject matter influence Van Gogh's work that we see on display here?
Sure, we're showing a collection of Japanese prints. These are not the exact prints that belong to Van Gogh, but they are closely related to the ones that he owned. And he, again, was very inspired by their use of color, by their use of cropping, and certainly they're very unusual for Western standards views of nature. We're also, however, including a group of 19th century photographs. And Van Gogh himself was very dismissive of photography. He didn't own very much of it. He didn't claim not to like it. And this is really the first opportunity that anyone's ever looked at photography in Van Gogh. And we're not certain that he was directly influenced by it, but we found it very interesting that there are a number of photographs in the period that are doing the very same things that he's doing in the painting. And so we're sort of throwing this out as a sort of topic for people to think about.
And judging it from a stylistic perspective, many of the things that we see on display in these works are things that we see in some of Van Gogh's more important public works. How important was the work from this period in sort of securing Van Gogh's place in the history of art?
This is really the most critical, I think, period of his career, this period from Paris to the end of his life in Auvers, for establishing his reputation. I think if he had stopped, perhaps when he arrived in Paris, we wouldn't be studying him very much today. We might not be holding major exhibitions of his work if he had ceased painting in 1886. This is clearly the period when he is so inspired by what he's seeing around him that the people really inspire him as well.
And to close, what does this exhibit tell us about Van Gogh that other exhibits maybe have sort of not touched on in the past? Why is this exhibit so important?
I think this exhibit has really allowed us to look closely at the paintings and to really think about Van Gogh as an innovator and to just actually stop and, you know, we sometimes get very bogged down in the story of his life and you know, it's a classic tale of a tortured artist who has a quite tumultuous life, and sometimes that can take us away a little bit from the paintings. And so this exhibition is organized in such a way to allow you to really stop and look at the pictorial strategies and how he's really pushing the boundaries of art in the late 19th century and producing pictures that sort of overturn the traditional rules of picture making and are some of the most radical and inventive works of their day.
And that was Jenny Thompson, the curator at the Philadelphia Museum, speaking to Monocle's Barrett Austin. It's 3 minutes before the top of the hour, so that's all we have time for this Monday's edition of Midori House. Today's show is produced by Katie Bilboa and was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andy Carter. In 3 hours' time, it'll be time for the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time, when Ted Kravitz will be joined by Tom Burgess Watson. They'll be going undercover in Syria and visiting a sportswear fair. The headlines are next right here on Monocle 24. We'll play out on a song, though. This is Valentine by Jessie Ware and Sampa. But from me, Emma Nelson, thanks for listening. Bye-bye. ¶¶